From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Irony can sound like just another tool in the stand-up comedian's kit bag, like easy eye-rolling detachment in the next cubicle, like snark, like sarcasm. In fact, says philosopher Jonathan Lear, it's much bigger, deeper than those. Back to Socrates and Kierkegaard. And forget the end of irony, he says. We need irony now. This hour on Point, a philosopher's call to bring on the irony. Joining me now from Chicago is Jonathan Lear, professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago. He's been lecturing all over on irony lately, UCLA, Columbia, Emory, Michigan State, Notre Dame, Purdue, Yale. He's drawn on a series of lectures at Harvard for his new book, A Case for Irony. Professor Lear, Jonathan Lear, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be here.
And with us today, ironic and otherwise, are on own On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, it's great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Lear.
Jonathan.
Jack, it's nice to meet you, and please call me Jonathan.
Great.
I'll do it.
Great. It's great to have everybody here. Jonathan Lear, we look around. You say a case for irony as though it needs to be made, but, you know, despite the calls, a decade ago now for the end of irony or this assertion that irony was over, don't we live in a world that's full of irony? Aren't you surrounded by people making ironic asides and remarks all the time? Sometimes I feel I am.
Yes, well, you know, I read the same column you did at the right after September 11th, and saying the age of irony is over. And I thought the age of irony is just going to begin. But what I mean by irony is more or less the opposite of what that columnist who wrote for Roger Rosenblatt, writing for Time, meant, and what I think we normally mean in contemporary culture. I think that there's been a conception of irony that's very, very important to the kinds of creatures we are, and that Socrates was very alive to, and Plato was very alive to. Another hero of mine is Kierkegaard, because I think he understood Plato and Socrates, that has largely been lost. So when we talk about irony in contemporary culture, I think we're talking about something very different, although related to the phenomenon, I think, Plato, Socrates, Kierkegaard, and now, you know, I'm trying to bring to light. And the reason I thought that the column about the age of irony being over had gotten it precisely wrong is I assumed that, and I think it's played out, that we were going to enter an age of anxiety about what it any longer meant or would mean in the future to be an American. And here the issue is, I think, you know, America is such a special country because it is founded around certain ideals, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, that all men are created equal, that we have a right to assembly, to free speech. And I assumed that there would be, and I think there it has played out, more and more anxiety about what these core values mean and how they're going to be applied now and into the future. And the other feature about it is that these ideals are not just sort of ideals that one might, anyone might aspire to, but they are ideals that we identify with ourselves insofar as we take ourselves to be Americans. And so this is, I think, a very, very crucial point in the irony I'm interested in, is that although there are all sorts of derivative uses, the one that concerns me the most is when it strikes each person as a first personal problem. It's a problem either for me as an individual or for us as a group, or for me insofar as I'm part of a we that matters.
You know, Jonathan, and we don't get to dive into Socrates and Kierkegaard every day here, so I'm looking forward to that. But I kind of want to just look at the stake in the ground that came after 9/11 first.
Please.
And we put this essay up. This is from Roger Rosenblatt. This was September 24th, 2001. The essay is up at our website, onpointradio.org, as well as a long essay by Jonathan Lear that will take you into his theory of the case here. But Jonathan, Jack, listen with me for just a second. This is Roger writing just days after 9/11. He said, "One good thing to come from this horror, it could spell the end of the age of irony. For some 30 years, this is back in 2001, roughly as long as the Twin Towers were upright, the good folks in charge of America's intellectual life have insisted that nothing was to be believed or taken seriously. Nothing was real. With a giggle and a smirk, our chattering classes declared that detachment and personal whimsy were the necessary tools for an oh-so-cool life. He wrote, the ironists seeing through everything made it difficult for anyone to see anything. The consequence of thinking that nothing is real is that one will not know the difference between a joke and a menace, no more. Jack B., Roger Rosenblatt was writing that at a time when we had all been shocked, terribly sober by 9/11, and he was wanting to sort of, you know, swipe down the curtains of irony and go straight to what's real. Jonathan Lear is in a way saying we need to get what's real through a kind of irony here, Jack.
Well, yes, and Jonathan points out that for Kierkegaard, irony, rightly understood as a kind of questioning of our basic premises, was what we lost after, in quote, losing irony after 9/11. That is, we all became locked in the illusion of our righteousness, of our, we were injured, this had never happened before, anything quite like this, an attack on the homeland that justified anything we would want to do, even a war that many think was illegal and all know was conducted on false premises. So we sort of went crazy in our righteousness. And I think that shows what happens when you lose the sense of irony.
Jack, I couldn't agree more with that. I think it's interesting to see that, you know, just going back to Socrates for a moment, I mean, he went around saying things like, I'm the only doctor in all of Athens, or I am the only statesman in all of Athens. And of course, as you know, he wasn't practicing anything that looked like a medicine of the time, and he didn't go to the assembly unless he actually had to. He wouldn't participate in juries. So it looked like he was saying the opposite of what he meant. But the Greek term ironia does mean dissembling or putting on a mask, and people who got irritated with him accused him of being ironic in that sense of that we're familiar with, of saying the opposite of what you mean. What Plato, I think, saw was that Socrates was being entirely earnest in his statements, and then he was, I think, ironic about irony. He used the term got used to, and certainly Kierkegaard did, to sort of point out, well, Socrates took himself to be the only person who really was concerned with promoting health of his citizens. He really was the only one who was promoting the good of the polis. So that, you know, it looks superficially like he was saying the opposite of what he meant or being detached. And I think what Plato, Kierkegaard really saw about him, that this was a profound form of earnestness. And so, you know, in contemporary America, when you come up with questions like, well, a point that I think Jack was saying, you know, we've become crazy in our righteousness. I think that what has happened is that there's a tremendous outpouring of anxiety about the future of these ideals that are our ideals, and in that sense, some sense, us. And what would it be anymore to be an American?
You write, Jonathan, you say, we tend to think casually of the ironist as someone who is able to make certain forms of witty remarks, perhaps saying the opposite of what he means, of remaining detached by undercutting any manifestation of seriousness. But you're looking all the way back to Socrates and saying, well, in fact, real irony is a kind of detachment, but it's a way of coming back around to point at the gap between what we're actually doing and what we attest that we ought to be doing.
I agree with that. And if you look at the great ironist, there's always a question that sounds weird. Socrates' question would be something like, among all statesmen, is there a statesman? Do we have a politician in all of our politicians? I think Jesus' question was something like, among all the Jews, is there a Jew? Kierkegaard's question was, among all Christians, is there a single Christian? And it's amazing that we can immediately hear that there's a question being asked because, you know, on the face of it, there's just a repetition of the same term. I mean, if you say something like, among all ducks, is there a duck? It just doesn't, you know, no question is heard. But these
humans have ideals and we fall short of those ideals. And when we do, we may be called out through irony.
That's right. And it's not just about falling short. I mean, this is, I think, a very important mm-hmm. point, which I only came to realize as I continue to work on it. It's one thing to realize that you're falling short of some ideal and either decide to live up to it or try to live up to it or feel guilty about it or whatever. It's quite another to have that question make you anxious and disturb you. And I think this is the key idea of irony that these great thinkers were getting at, and I'm trying to recover, that it's a kind of anxiety where you know, like in the case of contemporary America, like what are going to happen to our values?
That a kind of existential disturbance, and a good disturbance, may be brought on by irony itself. Jonathan Lear is author of the new book, A Case for Irony. Jonathan, please stand by there in Chicago. Jack Beatty, it's great to have you. Listeners, do you remember post 9/11, the end of irony? Is it time to bring it back? Bring it back more deeply to look at ourselves today. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a philosopher's call to bring on the irony, to deepen our understanding of irony, to test our commitment to our own ideals, to our own humanity. Not everybody's even exactly sure what irony is once you really dig into it. Here's the 1994 movie Reality Bites. Winona Ryder's character is applying for a job at a newspaper. She's asked during the job interview to define irony. She's stumped.
Define irony.
Irony. It's a noun. It's when something is ironic. I can't really define irony, but I know when I see it.
I know it when I see it. Is it really so hard to find? I'm not so sure. Tune into The Daily Show almost any evening. Jon Stewart seems to use irony aplenty. One of President Obama's first acts on taking office in January 2009 was to announce he would close the prison at Guantanamo Bay within a year. The Daily Show host, comedian Jon Stewart, wondered about that.
As Hillary Clinton was revitalizing the State Department rank and file, one of the diplomatic albatri, around their necks was being removed. As President Obama moved to close the infamous prison at Guantanamo Bay.
Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
A year? Not to be a jerk, but how much packing does it really take to close? What, you got a mattress, a couple of Korans? Telling you, Moishas could do it in an afternoon. They could do it. It's true.
Sounds like irony to me, and tune in any night to Stephen Colbert. He was just last month, Colbert was with his shtick, sort of deadpanning as the ultra-clean-cut hyper-patriot, complaining about the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Enormous news today, folks. We know we're all getting sick of the Occupy Wall Streeters. It's been 2 months. We get it. My fellow 1%er, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, had to take action.
New York City is the city where you can come and you can express yourself. And what was happening in Zuccotti Park was not that. It had developed into a situation which was prohibiting a lot of people from expressing their views.
Clearly, their expression was prohibiting other expression. After all, when a drum circle starts in Zuccotti Park, all other music in New York stops.
It's funny, maybe a little irony there, too. All right, Jonathan Lear, there's Jon Stewart, there's Stephen Colbert. Have we not got irony right in the middle of our popular culture right there?
Those are beautiful examples, both of them. I mean, one way to sort of think about this is the Guantanamo case is, among all presidential orders, is there a presidential order? What is it for a president to actually issue an order? And I think this is, and I think that part of it, it's funny, but it also, it's the kind of funny that can shake one if one thinks about, well, what would it be to for a president to, you know, our president to shut down what he himself and many others thought is a, you know, grave injustice. I mean, there's still, you know, men in cages under you know, American supervision.
Much more than a year later now.
Yeah, and I think the Occupy Wall Street, I mean, it's wonderful, and I think that use of humor that both of them use is absolutely on target, because A, there's the amusement, but, you know, laughter is always a, you know, real laughter is a recognition of a kind of a gap, and I don't think that laughter is ever that far away from a certain kind of anxious recognition that things aren't quite as they should be. Part of what I think is so ingenious about the Occupy Wall Street movement was it was trying to form a kind of expression, and I think this was an earnest expression, without having to make any particular move to say that this particular thing is wrong. There was basically a standing witness to what I take to be the overall message, which was there's a disparity of income. There's an income gap in this wealth gap in this country that is actually a problem for, you know, a long-term problem for the country. And I think it was, I heard so many criticisms of this group saying, well, they're not really saying anything, and they aren't really expressing themselves. Mm. I actually think it was a marvelous form of expression, and I think making fun of Bloomberg saying that they you know, that he's in favor of expressing himself as much as anybody was right on target.
Jack Beatty, I mean, with Jon Stewart on the air every night and Stephen Colbert and maybe even Occupy Wall Street for so many weeks, you know, grunging it out right under the towers of platinum and gold-plated bonuses. I mean, do you think we suffer some shortage of irony in this country, this culture right now?
Well, I think we may have irony in the, what, second degree, but not in the third degree. And I think this is the value, to me at least, of Jonathan's study. He takes it another step. And let me put it mm-hmm. this way. Matthew Arnold in Culture and Anarchy uses this saying, never go against the best light you have, but take care that your light be not darkness. Now, that second part, that your light be not darkness, I take it, Jonathan, that's what you're concerned with. Not simply reflecting on taking care that our light, you know, that we're going according to our best light, but questioning the light. Is this the...
I think that's right, Jack. No, Jack, I really agree with you, and I think this is the point of why I keep insisting on the issue of anxiety. Because, for one thing, there's a question of let our light not be darkness. I mean, here's the value, which is the freedom of expression. You know, Congress shall not inhibit the freedom of expression. This is one of our views. Now, there's a, you know,
more than a view, a fundamental founding principle.
It's defining who we are. Mm. As a collective, as a political people. And there's one thing to raise the question, are we really living up to it, or have we failed in this? And by the way, I mean, not in New York, but in California, there was violence in closing down these peaceful
yes.
protests. You know, one of our poet laureate was beaten and knocked to the ground, as was his wife. I mean, and so
and
there's
even
an issue.
In New York, it got pretty rough out there sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it got very rough. And I think that, so there's one issue about, are we living up to our ideal to allow the freedom of expression? But there's another level where we come, and this is, I think, the anxious, ironic level, where in the joke can bring it to light, which is, what is it to express ourselves? What is it to have the freedom to express ourselves? What is that value? How do we live according to that value so that value itself doesn't become a source of darkness, which I would think of as a routine cliche? We all know that you can do this, but you can't do that. What is it to keep that value as a kind of vibrant, alive, calling us to order? And again, you know, living by these fundamental values always requires putting up with things that you may not yourself like. That's why we have values and laws, because they're always tested over things that we may not ourselves like to put up with. And no doubt people who are working down in Wall Street didn't like the mess of Zuccotti Park, and maybe, you know, it was a mess, and it certainly was an inconvenience for many. But it's the reason these values are important is because they force us to live up to things that we may find inconvenient. And the darkness is coming in and, I think, revising the concept or the value or the basic principle downward into something that becomes quite routine. And I think one of the great values of irony is it's a kind of humorous, anxious disruptor of routines, but not for the sake of detachment or irony as we normally understand it, but for a deep recommitment to the fundamental value with which we started, the freedom to express oneself.
You write of Socrates talking about this as the greatest of goods and how unsettling, I guess, irony can be. Socrates says, God-sent madness is a finer thing than man-made sanity. And you say Plato also talks about the importance of the disruptive, disorienting experience as that from which philosophical activity emerges. God-sent madness over man-made sanity, why would that be the greatest of goods in this context?
Isn't that great? Well, Socrates was actually talking about homosexual love there. It's the, you know, what he was talking about in that context in the Phaedrus was the shock of the beautiful other. In his case, it would be the shock of the beautiful younger boy. But
you're linking it here also to the kind of unsettling moment of irony that Plato holds up.
Well, he thought that beauty was a very disruptive kind of God-sent madness that was useful in breaking out of our routine understandings in order to sort of focus us on more ultimate, he thought, transcendent forms. Now, I don't think you have to go along with all of Plato's metaphysics to think that he got the psychology right, that the experience of profound beauty can be this enormously disruptive, anxious-making force, not to look for in a kind of transcending force, but not in the metaphysical sense of some other realm, in the sense of just breaking us out of one's ordinary routines. And so we've been talking about, American principles like all humans are created equal. This has been an extraordinarily, American history has been an extraordinarily painful attempt to live up to this ideal. And there are these, these shocking moments. Sometimes one is shocked by the very beauty of this founding ideal to realize that, one's normal understanding of what it would be to treat one's fellow men as created equal has been, routine.
But that doesn't mean giving up
on the ideal. It means it's the opportunity for a recommitment at a very deeper level of what that might mean.
Jack, it's funny. At an easy level, I can't say that I would instantly couple profound beauty and irony. Now, maybe the most beautiful thing have an ironic charge that lifts them up above sort of everyday, nicely symmetrical beauty. Jack, what do you say?
I think that's the notion, that what we think of as beautiful isn't so beautiful. There's a higher beauty, something or another kind of beauty, and we get a sense of it when we have this moment of irony. But it isn't a comfortable moment. And Jonathan, the figure you used that struck me was that of Socrates on the eve of a battle. And he's simply standing still. He stands still all night. And people are thinking, well, what's he doing? Why is he just standing still? And in some ways, I thought, well, that's quite a figure of for what can happen to us when we're open to irony, when we're open to the notion that our idea of beauty isn't beauty, when we're open to the notion that our idea of democracy isn't democracy, that it can paralyze us. And yet you also point out that on the next day, Socrates fought and fought well.
Jack, I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the things I'd just like to say about beauty is that I've just read a book by a colleague, Richard Neer, on Greek statues. And he makes this point that, we always think of the Greeks as this classical beauty, austere classical beauty.
Yes.
He talks about that it was meant to stun us. And thauma is a kind of, philosophy begins in wonder. The beauty begins by stunning us, the wondrous nature of this beauty. And You know, with Socrates standing still, there's this lovely passage. It's in the Symposium where Alcibiades is talking about, it's almost a love song to Socrates, where Socrates just stands still all night and the troops gather round overnight just to watch him not moving. And the general interpretation of this passage is that, you know, Socrates is this wonderful, eccentric character. He's so busy thinking a problem through that he sort of loses, you know, he's like the absent-minded professor of ancient Greece. My interpretation is different. I think that Socrates isn't moving because he doesn't yet know how to move, that the thing he's thinking about is not sort of some abstract geometrical problem. It's like, what is the next step I ought to take? And he's been stunned by ideals of, like, what would it be to take to be courageous? What would the next courageous step be? And this is why, again, I you know, insist that the central issue is first personal. The real irony is when it's striking you in the first person. And then Socrates had this, as you point out, Jack, this uncanny ability, although he stays up all night thinking about what to do, when the requirements of the day, the next day, are A, to make a prayer, which one conventionally does, and B, to then go into battle in a very conventional form of bravery, Socrates is reported as having sort of outdone all his peers as a courageous person normally understood. So that for Socrates, in this instance, the irony of his coming to a standstill, and here I do see a great similarity to the standing still of the Occupy movement today, that didn't get in the way of him participating the next day. It actually invigorated him.
Still, until he wasn't. Jonathan Lear's book is a case for irony. Let's go to our listeners. Byfield, Massachusetts. Sean is calling. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because thinking back to 2001 and wondering if the panel could sort of draw a distinction between an ironic reaction to a situation and a cynical one. I'm thinking particularly of the reaction by Cheney and Bush and how that led to a more dark view of things than
Our time is short, Sean, but that, or even more broadly, Jonathan Lear, irony versus cynicism.
Yeah. Well, the irony, as I understand it, would be that a fundamental challenge was raised about how are we going to continue to, I mean, literally to be ourselves in the face of this challenge. And by being ourselves would mean remaining committed to the very fundamental values of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of conscience, freedom of the press, and the commitment that all humans are created equal, that this was going to be challenging our fundamental commitments as well as to, commitments about human rights. And so what would the ironic reaction would be, this is an occasion, an anxious occasion for sort of falling in love all over again with these fundamental core principles and showing the world that even this dreadful attack upon the country is not going to get in the way of a renewed commitment to these ideals that we, you know, and I think love is the right word. I mean, I think Plato thought of this kind of irony as fundamentally erotic in his sense of falling in love with the ideal that would, if you could live up to it, be you. Now, you know, I don't want to make any claims about Bush or Cheney. I don't, you know, I mean, I've read the paper like everybody else. But what I do want to say is I think if you look at what happened in America then, and I think it continues to this day, that there's something very basic we almost all of us share, although we then polarize out in different directions about what to do about it. And I think what we share and what happened then, and this is why I thought the age of irony was just beginning and not ending, was that we share a deep anxiety about what America is going to be.
Jonathan Lear, hold the thought right there. We're up against a break. Irony is our subject. Jonathan Lear is with us. Jack Beatty, too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a philosopher's call to bring on the irony, to deepen our understanding of irony. Jonathan Lear is with us. His new book is A Case for Irony. a decade ago, a big challenge to that. Here's a little tape. This is September 2001, a moment on The Daily Show again, where Vanity Fair magazine editor Graydon Carter had recently pronounced that irony is dead following the attacks. Jon Stewart took this long jab at Carter's comment.
I keep seeing over these past couple of weeks people trying to make cultural pronouncements about what these terrible events will mean for our culture. And the one that I keep seeing is that irony has passed, that it is the death of irony. But I was thinking maybe we should wait to make pronouncements about what will happen to us culturally until the fire's completely put out. Don't you think? I mean, it's still smoking down there. Maybe we shouldn't necessarily decide what's the rest of history of man going to be. No? And why did irony have to die? Why couldn't puns have died?
Why couldn't puns have died? It may not have died. Jonathan Lear says, bring it back and deepen our understanding of it. He joins us from Chicago. Jack Beatty is with us. Let's go to Elizabeth in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Elizabeth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. It's interesting you're having this conversation. I just had, within the last couple of days, a conversation with my 15-year-old about hypocrisy and irony. And my example to him was that, for instance, hypocrisy is when Newt Gingrich engages in investigating and prosecuting Clinton while knowingly committing the same act.
This is about Monica irony. Lewinsky while he was having his own affair. Mm-hmm.
Right, and yeah. Exactly. And the irony is, with each new Republican candidate frontrunner, the GOP gets further away from their ideals. And so that was my kind of way of saying, I don't think that hypocrisy is when you know it and you're doing it opposite. Irony is when it happens to you, but you had no idea it happened, that you were doing it.
Yeah. Virginia, how did your 15-year-old respond?
Very well, because he's always very interested in what the nuances of different words mean, because he hears them being used in inappropriate ways. So hopefully I got it right. But no, he is very interested in all of those things. He loves Jon Stewart and Colbert. And when he was young, he used to get very upset with Colbert because he didn't understand sarcasm.
Jonathan Lear, there's the sound of a mother, a parent working hard to do her duty to sort of transmit insight to her child. How's she doing?
Right. Great work. And I think, in a political context, what Elizabeth's comment brought into my mind was Obama's speech on race, that early speech when he was still a candidate. Mm-hmm. I mean, one way to hear that speech, and I think what made it, I think, one of his ironic moments, was to say, look, among all of our conversations about race, can't we have a single conversation about race? And I think what made it such an extraordinary piece of political oratory, I think this was really one of his best, was precisely that sense of appealing to our own sense of, well, yes, it actually, there's so much chatter going on about race, but might it not be possible actually to have a conversation about race?
To cut through the chatter for once and really
take it
head on.
And I think that's the can you cut through the chatter?
Richard in Groton, Connecticut. Richard, you're on the air with Jonathan Lear. Hello, Richard. Are you there, my friend?
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Are we all set? Okay, yeah. It occurred to me, you're playing Jon Stewart, and I think that's the perfect example of what I'm about to talk about, that a few years ago, listening to Jon Stewart and realizing that I was probably getting the essence of truth more from him than any place else, it occurred to me that the precursor often to major social change is an uptick in satire and irony as a way of communicating, perhaps because it's safer to communicate that way, perhaps it's because it's easier for people to understand it that way. But if you look at Voltaire before the French Revolution, even at the American Revolution, there was a lot of satire that was communicated, and I think it's an indication of the concern I have for our society today. The Wall Street thing was certainly another indication that we are in a very tense time at a social level, and I think that your speakers there could probably respond to that more than perhaps I could go on.
Richard will pick it right up, and I'm sure they can. Jack, I'll come first to you. If I may, Jack, here's a web comment from Janet. She says maybe, and it comes back to Richard's point, but maybe two of the more effective signs or slogans from Occupy Wall Street are examples of Jonathan Lear's irony, and she quotes two here. One, I guess these are signs or slogans she's seen with Occupy. Here's one. I can't afford my own lobbyist, so I made this sign. And two, I'll accept that corporations are people when Texas executes one. Jack, do you see a little percolating upheaval, social change, time of big change in the energy of irony there?
Well, that last sign is redolent of Mark Twain, isn't it?
Yes, I'd say. And
Mark Twain, you know, it overstates his importance, but not by much, to see him as a precursor, really, of the whole progressive movement. You know, his satire, his sustained satire of the Gilded Age. He wrote a novel, a send-up of the Gilded Age, which the essence of which was business corrupting politics, or the mutual corruption of business and politics. And the progressive era was an effort to try to pry them apart with laws saying you corporations couldn't contribute to campaigns. And, of course, in 2007, the Supreme Court threw that law out the window. But you could see in Mark Twain, really, the beginnings in his satire of a political movement. So I think Richard's point is well taken in the example of Twain and the progressive movement, as well as the others he gave.
Jonathan Lear,
I do too. I think it's a good example. And, you know, the last figures I looked at is 82% of the American people disapprove of Congress. You know, and it's just at this time that phrases are coming up like the best Congress that money can buy. Mm. I think Twain is a real great example of an American ironist. But the issue again is these frustrations and criticisms come from not from detachment. There's a moment of detachment, but they come because we actually really care about these institutions. Mm-hmm. And the irony is a manifestation of a kind of caring, not a form of like detachment or cynicism. Mm.
Trevor in Boston, you're on the air, Trevor.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I just heard you guys talking about satire and irony in the same breath, and that's confusing for me because big difference there. I wonder, I think your guest was just talking a little bit about the difference there, talking about how irony is something a little deeper than satire, but can you talk about that a little more?
Yes, please. I mean, and Mark Twain is not a bad place to start. You called him a great American ironist, Jonathan, but you can often hear him called a great American satirist. What about the distinction between irony and satire?
Well, I think the biggest distinction, as far as I'm concerned, is that irony, when it's working, I'm talking about the paradigm case, mm-hmm. As I understand it, is essentially first personal. It's not about making fun of the other person. It's about anxiously wondering how to be the person one wants to be. And thus, I think, you know, it's a really good question because there are, you know, important derivative senses that I come close to satire. But the real issue, and this it's taken me a long time to come to see this, is where a question like, among all Americans, is there an American, is something that in the most important sense, it's about either me personally, how I'm going to continue to be, or it's about us, my sense of we, where I myself am very implicated in the we. And just thinking that it's somebody else's fault or somebody else is worthy of being made fun of is not the core issue. It's a way to shake oneself out of one's own routines in order to recommit, and as Plato said, erotically, to the very same ideals, but now differently understood than what one before one got this sort of ironic wake-up call.
And you say erotically. I read you in your book, A Case for Irony, by that meaning with great passion for that.
Passion and longing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what Socrates thought eros, the erotic, is all about. It's the longing that gets instilled in you for you sort of know not what. When you see somebody that you take to be really beautiful, stunningly beautiful, there's an attraction to him or her, but it's also a kind of stunned disruption of like not really quite sure what that is that you are longing
but
for.
But you may know. I mean, it may be just a yardstick to measure how much do you really want that American ideal manifested versus just kind of riding along on its coattails. Jack, what about this line between irony and satire in contemporary culture?
I think Jonathan is onto something. Satire does make fun of others, and I would think that the point about irony is it comes back on you. It comes back on yourself. It's a moment of self-reflection. And in that sense, it's a deeper and more complicated thing. And you know, there's a show business saying irony is what, I mean, satire is what closed on Saturday night. That satire doesn't sustain, mm-hmm. you know, it just doesn't sustain going to laugh at the bourgeoisie or whatever it is, mm-hmm. because heck, we're all bourgeoisie in some, at some, at some level. And so I think it's a thinner thing entirely. But, you know, we have in our history the great example of an ironist in Jonathan's terms. And this is brought out by Reinhold Niebuhr in his book, The Irony of American History. And it's the figure of Lincoln, who's fighting the greatest war in history. Yeah. And yet who said, we both pray to the same God. Mm-hmm. We both think we're right. We both can't be right, but that's what we think. We can't judge these people because they think they're right, and yet in the crux, he's not weakened by this view of the relativity of virtue. He's strengthened by it. He's Socrates who takes the step the next day, even though he sees how, in some sense, all virtues are even the righteousness of the union cause is in some way relativized by at least the claim of the Confederates. We think we pray to the same God.
Jonathan, you point to the same presidential sort of archetype or arc example of the ironic mastery in Lincoln.
Well, I think, you know, Lincoln is somebody I've just been reading. I've just read that very same speech, Jack, and. You know, I think he was he did say explicitly that if he were in the position of the South, he would have the same beliefs the people in the South have. He never mm-hmm. lost that view that, you know, there, I think there but for the grace of God go mm-hmm. I. But he had this wonderful line, which I do think this is an ironic moment in my sense, where he was talking about people who were, you know, arguing in favor of slavery. And he said, well, you know, slavery seems to be this good that everybody wants for somebody else.
Yes.
nobody seems to want slavery for themselves. And that, I think, is a lovely ironic moment because, you know, A, it has the humor in it, but also there's something fundamentally disruptive if you allow yourself to think about it. I mean, how could there be this good that we just want other people to have and not for ourselves?
You too could be a slave, but you probably wouldn't choose to.
I think Lincoln was our greatest ironist president. Mm.
John in Barrie, Vermont. You're on the air, John.
Yes, gentlemen. I'd like to throw William Shakespeare into the hat. His lines, 'tis true, 'tis pity, 'tis pity, 'tis true, mm. or conscience makes cowards of us all. And on and on, is a great example for me for irony. You want to comment on that?
Jonathan Lear, Shakespeare.
What is it to have a father? Our conscience makes cowards of us all. I actually think that he's that phrase is a description of the kind of anxious moment that I am talking about, a kind of disruption there where he too. I mean, here's another man who comes to a halt. Hamlet does, but you know, it seems to me here's a case of a kind of pathology where he's not able to use this moment of anxiety to actually take a step forward. And so, I see him as a kind of as vulnerable to this kind of disruptive anxiety, but sort of you might say pathologically trapped in. Not being able to go forward as Socrates was the next morning to take a kind of resolute step. I think Shakespeare was examining that.
Mm-hmm. You take this back again and again, Jonathan, to our basic humanity. Kierkegaard, you jump from Plato and Socrates to Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard, of course, writing, this is in his journal in 1854, to become human does not come that easily. And you bring irony forward as that kind of, I don't know, spade or shovel that we shove in there to try and upturn and ask again, are we really achieving it?
Yeah. No, I think that's Kierkegaard saying to become human it doesn't come that easily is one of his great great lines. And I think he was talking about Socrates. And I think the point is, and I think this is a very important point about the humanities in general, that we are creatures who not only live with ideals that define us. We take ourselves to be fathers and mothers and sons and daughters and lovers and haters and Americans and whatever religious beliefs or other countries, other ideals, teachers, journalists. And these categories, even like a category of a journalist, now we're talking about the first person with you, the second person for me. What would it be to live up to the ideal of being a journalist, communicating the truth to a citizenry so that they can make better informed decisions? Whatever those ideals are, they A, define us, or we define ourselves with respect to them, and they shake us up because there's something about the ideal that itself is unsteady. And so, you know, the great challenge of human life is how do you live well with your own ideals? And what I've been sort of commending, I think what the issue of irony is learning to live well with a certain kind of capacity to disrupt the very ideals which you take to be the most important to who you are is itself a very important aspect of who you are.
Jack Beatty, we all know what happened with Socrates at the end. There was that cup of hemlock. This is not necessarily a popular road, but yeah, Jonathan Lynn makes the case an absolutely critical one, Jack.
Absolutely, and he quotes Kierkegaard about people who, well, I'll just quote it, from the fact that irony is present, it does not follow that earnestness is excluded. That is something only assistant professors assume.
Well, Kierkegaard didn't have to live through the American tenure system. Yeah,
Jonathan Lear's new book is A Case for Irony, professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago. It's been great having you with us today, Jonathan. Thank you so much for your insights.
Tom, thank you very much. Jack, thank you very much.
Wonderful as always to have you, Jack. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. Said without irony, though we could go there, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.